This is Bill Block, recorded at Peterhouse College, Cambridge, on the 16th of September 2007 by Chris Eldon Lee. Bill Block.
William Block, known as Bill Block, living in Cambridge now, and born on the 22nd of February 1937.
In?
In Lowestoft, in Suffolk. Educated as a local grammar school boy, and then went up to Durham University, where I read zoology under Jim Cragg, who was professor, and Martin Holgate was one of my lecturers. And after graduation in 1960, I stayed on for PhD research at Moorhouse National Nature Reserve, again firstly under Jim Cragg and later under John Coulson, and completed a PhD in 63 when I took my first job, which was abroad in Uganda.
Uganda, not south?
No, it went. We went to the tropics first, to Makerere University College, as it was then, where I was lecturer in zoology.
How then was it that you came to go south in 71?
Well, very interested in soil fauna. That was my main PhD work. And so I was very keen to go to the tropics to see how the soil fauna varied and lived under those very extreme conditions. So I then got involved in looking at the adaptations of various members of the soil fauna, particularly the insects and the mites, and to see how they adapted to very hot conditions. And when I got back to the UK in 1967, my thoughts turned to sort of more temperate climates and temperate soil conditions. And from then, I became interested in cold conditions. And through my friend Peter Tilbrook, we began to think about a possible visit to the Antarctic. So I went from the hot through the intermediate to the cold.
But your first trip to the Antarctic in 71, but that was purely leisure, was it?
No, this was work. I had a Leverhulme Research Fellowship, and I got a leave of absence from University of Leicester, where I was then lecturing, for 7 months. And, of course, going as a visitor, visiting scientist to British Antarctic Survey, at the invitation of Dr. Dick Laws, who was then head of the survey, to visit various sub-Antarctic and maritime Antarctic islands with Peter Tilbrook to conduct a research programme during the 71-72 season. So it was purely as a visitor, but as a working scientist.
Just thinking back, had you had a kind of secret hankering to go south? If you'd worked with Professor Cragg as a student, had you been inspired or injected with the passion at that point?
I was indeed, yes. From a very early time in my undergraduate career, I always wanted to go and look at sort of difficult places, extreme conditions. I was president of the Durham University Exploration Society for a couple of years. I led expeditions to Libya, to the Libyan desert, and also I was a member of an expedition to Arctic Norway. So I was very keen to travel, I was very keen to look at different climatic regimes and their effect on the biology.
But no special desire to go to the Antarctic?
Well, there was really, in a way, because I was very envious, because at the time as an undergraduate, again as president of the Biological Society, we used to organise talks, you see, every week or so in term time. And Prof Cragg came up to me one day and said, "Block," he said, "I've got Bill Sloman coming up from the British Antarctic Survey, or FIDS as it was in those days. I want you to organise a BIOSOC meeting for him." So I organised this and chaired it, and Bill Sloman came and gave us a most wonderful talk on Antarctica, not just the biology, but all the scientific work that FIDS were doing in those days. And, of course, Peter Tilbrook was in the audience. And afterwards, we all went to dinner. Peter Tilbrook expressed an interest to Sloman that he was interested in that sort of thing. Peter graduated the following year, was appointed to FIDS, and off to the Antarctic. And I was left in Durham doing my PhD on Moorhouse. So I'd always had that kind of interest and longing to go, and was rather envious of my friend Peter going. And so it was marvellous in 1972 to get back to go down there with Peter and do this work.
Was it what you expected when you got there?
Very much so. I'd seen a lot of pictures and slides and been to talks and things in those days. So it was, yes, very much as I expected. It was probably a little bit, living conditions were fairly basic, but that was understandable. But what was most interesting was meeting this wide spectrum of characters on base. Hitherto I'd been nestled in academia, you know, with living and working with academics and so on, both abroad and in the UK, and particularly here in Cambridge for a while, and then being exposed to this very wide spectrum of humanity, builders, carpenters, electricians, diesel mechanics, other scientists and so on, base commanders or base leaders in those days. And it was a real, quite a revelation to me and an eye-opener that, you know, all these people, we could all work together as a team. And that was very impressive for me at that time.
Was there a moment of adjustment for you?
I think there was, yes. But I'm fairly naturally outward-going sort of person. I enjoy meeting people. So it was great to have a crack with all these different types of people. So, yes, I enjoyed base life enormously.
How did you adjust from academia to laying concrete and chipping rust off metal blocks?
Oh, very easily. I love that. I mean, I love do-it-yourself stuff anyway, and so I love to get involved with general work about the base. And one of my greatest pleasures, even subsequently, on subsequent visits to the Antarctic, was to do night watch. Because on base, and I think it happens now as it did then, because most of the buildings are potential fire hazards, we used to have a night watch. So from about 11 or midnight in the evening, one person would be awake all the way through the night and doing his rounds around the building complex to make sure there was no fire. And of course, if there was one, you raised the alarm. This included places like the generator shed that was with the diesels running, all the science labs and so on, the Met room and so on. And then in 6 o'clock in the morning, listening to the world service, getting the world news, pinning it up on the board, writing it out, pinning it on the board. So chaps, when they came to breakfast at 7:30, could read the latest news. And then I would do a fairly normal day's work till about 4 in the afternoon, and then go to bed and get up at midnight, and off we go again. And you did this for a week. And I'd love to do this because it was a, you know, it was a contribution to base life, as well as doing things like GASH, which is, you know, being the cook's assistant for the day. You can't really do much scientific work during that period. You actually just help the cook wash the pots and pans, lay the tables and things, and wash up afterwards. So night watch and GASH were very fine ways in which you could contribute, you know, to a base life, and I very much enjoyed that.
You're the first person to admit enjoying night watch. Is it because you were kind of alone in a strange place? Was there something in here, in the heart?
I think it was being alone that I enjoyed. I mean, because you appreciate on base normal days, people moving about, noises, being interrupted and so on, and the need actually to help each other, which I enjoyed also. But, you know, if somebody had a difficult dive or a lot of samples to carry to somewhere or bring back, then we would all join in and help. So that's another part of the teamwork. But at night you were alone, and at night, of course, you were in charge of the base. And I think perhaps that was the nice thing about it. Going up the back slope to the sunshine recorder, just actually changing the chart paper in the sunshine recorder as, you know, dawn was breaking and so on, even during summer, was a real thrill, you know. And that was, you were just alone in this world, and it was just magical.
Did you form some sort of spiritual bond with the place? Because you're still now, all these years later, organising reunions, so obviously it meant a great deal to you.
Yes, it did and it does, yes. I think there is, and I'm not alone in this. I think a lot of Signifids probably have this sort of allegiance, if I may put it so, to the island and to the station and the particular buildings that we inhabited during our times there. And this was evident yesterday, I think, after John Shears' talk on Signy Today, where a lot of older folk were saying, but that we lived in that building, why did you knock that down, why did you do this? They were curious, because that's part of their, if you like, their almost emotional heritage, if you like, in the Antarctic. And I think we all have a little bit of this, and I certainly do, yes.
They were also concerned about the growth of tourism, weren't they, as well? and you spoke from the floor, from the stage, saying that they shouldn't be concerned, but one didn't get the impression they were completely convinced by that.
Yes, that's true. Yes, I agree. I have the privilege of working on tour vessels and lecturing and talking to tourists in the Antarctic. And I repeat, my overall view is they're very responsible people, and the companies they go with as members of IATO, the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, are themselves extremely responsible. And so I'm impressed with the way in which they're conducted ashore, to land, to observe the wildlife and so on, to keep their distance and so on, and to have it interpreted by people like myself, and then to go on to other locations. I think it's a very responsible operation at the moment.
Yes, you don't suspect the thin end of a wedge, which may herald the arrival of the next wave of more cowboy-type operators.
Well, that's always a possibility, of course, because even IATO, or even the International Antarctic Treaty, if you like, can't really stop exploitation of this kind. But because IATO is there, I think it's actually helping to prevent, perhaps, the wedge getting much thicker. That's my feeling at the moment. Inevitably, larger ships, bigger capacity will come, but hopefully they won't be doing landings, they will be cruising, which in a way is much less likely to lead to environmental damage. It's the damage to the rather fragile terrestrial ecosystems that we're concerned about, as well, of course, damage to the marine ecosystem, but then not pumping the bilges, not discharging at sea and so on in the Antarctic is already followed by most ships anyway in that area. So it's the sort of land, it's the terrestrial environment we're concerned about.
There's money here, though, isn't there, from tourists? There's
very big.
Money to be made, and when money's been made, corners can be cut and
indeed,
standards can drop.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Yes, there's a lot of money in Antarctic tourism, but I think we should look at on the other side as well, that, you know, exposing, okay, a selected group of people to the Antarctic environment as tourists, they are obviously the ones that can afford it, but giving them that exposure also gives them the understanding. And I think this greater public understanding of what the Antarctic is about and what science is trying to do there and how we're trying to regulate things, I think can only be good, because the wider this exposure, the better, the more people know about it. Obviously, everybody can't go to the Antarctic. Only a select few can. But those who can, I think, usually come back with the message that, you know, we must try and conserve it, preserve it, and so on. So they come back, and they're very positive ambassadors for the Antarctic.
Let's go back to the 70s then, and your work in your lab. What were your research ambitions? What were you trying to achieve in the biological research you were doing?
Well, first of all, we wanted to find out what species lived in the soils in Antarctica, and of course, being a very cold environment, very few species exist there. For instance, comparing with a square metre of lawn in England, there would be something like maybe 2,000 to 3,000 species of individuals of animals in that quadrat of soil, whereas in the Antarctic you're probably down to something like less than 100 animals present in the same quantity of soil. So because you've got this simple community, fewer species and fewer individuals of each species, then you've got a much more simpler system, hopefully making it much easier to understand, to unravel, to find out who feeds on what they're eating, who the primary producers are, the plants, the microorganisms involved, and how the energy moves up through the food chain to the top predators and so on, and how the whole system functions as a unit, if you like.
By the time you got to the 70s, were you doing most of that homework on base, or were you still parceling stuff up and sending it to universities back in Great Britain?
Well, a large proportion of our work was obviously sampling, identifying what we could down in the field in our primitive laboratories, and then bringing quite a lot of preserved material back for verification in the UK. But then we got started on looking at the physiology of these animals, and I selected 3 or 4 species of arthropods, small insects, and mites, which we could actually get in sufficient numbers to do experiments on their physiology. And that's where I began to look at cold adaptation. In other words, how an insect, which is a poikilotherm, that means its body temperature follows that of the environment, unlike the human body, which is maintained in a homeostatic, stable temperature condition, the insects are not. So if the temperature goes below freezing in the Antarctic, in the soil, then all the insects in that area are obviously liable to freeze. So I got interested in looking at their cold tolerance and how they coped with low temperatures.
Were you still finding new species at that point, or had all that been done?
No, there's still, even today, still a large amount of effort needed to look at the distribution of the species we know and also to discover new ones. There probably are many more species there to look at. I think we've found about two new species to science in our work there over something, well, my work over about 21 years with bass.
Are they named after you?
One of them is, yes.
That was a guess.
Yes.
What is it?
Mucronothrus, I think, blocki, and it was named by a taxonomist for me, John Warwick, and we gave him the specimens, and he said, oh yes, I think there's a new species here, or two new species, and so he named them after Antarctic people, and so I was very honoured to have that.
How big is your creature?
It's about the size of a pinhead, so not a massive one, no.
Were you hampered by lack of technological support, or was everything you needed in place by then in the labs?
No, it was pretty good, actually. I mean, science does move on, of course, and one has to view this slice of time that you were operating there in. So during my time from 76 up till 97 when I retired, the technology sort of progressed throughout that, and as a team leader I began to look at the way in which we could provide the instruments and technical backup for the programs we were running. But to give you an example, for instance, when Peter and I went down in 71, we took a Cartesian diver microrespirometer, which I had built in University of Leicester, and we'd both used there and played about with. But it was a fairly technical thing because it involved a huge bath of ethylene glycol, which had to be kept at a very constant temperature, a temperature of plus or minus 0.01 degrees Celsius. So that was quite a task to buffer it and make it nice and stable. And within that we had chambers inside which we floated little divers. And these were handmade little glass divers about an inch long, in which we placed the animal under observation and with some sodium hydroxide. And so as the animal breathed, the CO2 given out, and oxygen taken in, the CO2 given out would be absorbed by the carbon dioxide. And this would alter the buoyancy of this very delicately balanced little diver. And so by using a pressure system on a manometer with a tube attached to the chamber in which the diver was, we could actually manipulate the position of this diver up and down in this little chamber. And by taking readings at regular intervals on what we call the equilibrium pressure, the pressure we needed to put on or take off on the system, on the liquid in which it was floating, we could actually measure the amount of oxygen that the little animal was taking up in over a period of time. Experiments lasted sometimes 5 or 6 hours, slightly longer at lower temperatures. So we could set this huge glycol bath at zero, plus 5, plus 10, and so on, and do experiments over many, many days on many individual animals. So this was the first time that we'd been able to measure how much oxygen these little creatures were actually consuming, and thereby get some handle on how much energy they were actually using from their food in their normal natural habitat. So we're thinking down to sensitivities of 10 to the minus 6 microliters. So a microliter is a millionth of a litre, so it's 10 to the minus 6 down below that. So it was a very, very sensitive thing. So we took this instrument down after constructing it in Leicester, put it in crates, took it all the way down to Cygni and set it up there, and within a week we had it running. And it stayed there for several years after that, run by our students and so on. So that's an example, if you like, of the technology that we used. And bass over the years has gone on and progressed more in the technology side, you know, with gas chromatograms taken down, to analyse the antifreezes in the insects and so on. We did all that on base as well. So yes, I think the technology, as it were, kept pace with the development of the science programmes.
When you went down most recently, which was 10 years ago?
Yes, well, no more than that, 95.
Yeah.
To Cygni.
What did you see which surprised you? How, in other words, how far had they gone with their technology? Perhaps you were envious of because you hadn't done that yourself.
Yes. Yes, I think I was. I mean, much more sophistication in the way of chromatograms and things that could be done on base, whereas the original chromatograms we did with paper chromatography to isolate glycerol and to measure how much glycerol was present in particular samples. But yes, I was quite envious. It had gone on very progressively, yes. And we had balances, for instance. We were able to have a microbalance that would weigh not the individual insect itself, but its individual fecal pellets and things like that. So, you know, yes, it had gone on, and of course one is quite envious of all this.
So by the 90s, a lab at Cygni was the same as a lab at the University in Britain?
Not quite, but almost, yes. Yes, that was about the level of it, yes, yes.
Were you base leader as well at one point, Bill?
No, I was never base leader, no. Because I joined BASS, as it were, permanently, as a married man with children in 1976, again, I never had the chance to overwinter because it wasn't BASS policy to allow us to do this. And I don't think I would have liked to have done anyway in those circumstances. But no, I became a scientific leader back in Cambridge on two of the major terrestrial projects.
Back to Cygni, let's talk a bit about the diving that took place, because you were there. Peter thought the first diving was 61, 62, so it was well established by the time you got there.
Yes.
What sort of routines were they doing? What were they doing? Was it a systematic programme of diving, or just a bob down and see what you can find?
No, it was fairly systematic, so there would be a number of marine projects running, and the diving officer, and I remember he was Paul Skilling in our day, my first visit, and Paul would organise that, you know, we would dive that day or that morning for that particular project, and then in the afternoon and so on. And so it was scheduled throughout the week, providing weather was okay. You were diving from a boat, of course, an open dinghy in those days, not even an inflatable. And Paul had charge of all that. So it was all sort of regulated and sorted out between the diver and the scientist. I never dived myself personally, but there were possibilities for some of us to do sort of what they call ENTS diving, entertainment diving, where Paul would take you down as a beginner and you'd show you the ropes and so on.
Did you that?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't.
As a waterman?
Not really, no. I refereed their water polo match on Christmas Day when we had a water polo match off the end of the jetty, and I was on the end of the jetty trying to blow a whistle, but that's the nearest I got to it, yes.
Yeah. In terms of the base, the human side of the base, how do you feel it has developed in 25 years or so you've known it, or 30 years you've known it? I mean, people always talk about the toilet facilities. I mean, when was the toilet breakthrough?
Well, I can't remember the actual date, but I know when I first went, there was on the plan, because it was built on the site of an old sealing station where they cut up the seals on the plan, the planks. There was a little box which was painted black and red. I remember it, and it was away from the plastic hut.
And that was you use that.
And that was the toilet, but it had one key feature, and this was a little wooden flag on a fulcrum. And when you were inside, you put the flag up. And when you'd finished and came out, you put the flag down. So people on a cold, wintry, blustery day could actually look out through the window and see whether the flag was up or down, as whether it was worth their while going to the toilet. And of course, there were those amongst us who forgot to bring the flag down when we'd finished. So there was a large number of us standing up at the window with our legs crossed and various other positions, waiting for the flag to go down that never did. So there was that, and there was another toilet we had. It's funny you get to talk about toilets, but they do become important in your life. And I remember this, it was at the end of the Tonsberg house, and I think this was in my first visit in 71, was just a very large bucket underneath a seat, and it was full of Elsan, of course, which we had to keep topped up, and I think it had to be emptied every 24 hours, and it was the job of the gash man to empty it. And this meant getting this large bucket full of this very nasty looking liquid, out of the door and down, often an icy slope, down to the sea edge, and tipping it into the water in the summer. In the winter, of course, it went through the tide crack, which is the bit between the sea ice and the land. And I remember one day doing this, I fell over, slipped over. Fortunately, it all went away through the shingle, but I mean, it was a precarious business doing this, and I remember that. And then later on, of course, subsequent visits, you go back to find there's a toilet, and then there are two toilets, and then there's a radiator put between the two toilets. And I mean, you know, the level of sophistication was growing by the year. It's quite magical. But the showers were the other thing. Again, when I first went in 71, we had a rather cold box down by the front door, no heating in it whatsoever. And we were allowed, I think, one shower a week. And it came down from the hot water tank in the bathroom above and, you know, was just gravity fed. And, of course, you know, if you were allowed, say, you know, 15 minutes maximum, and that was all the water you got. Because most of the hot water was used for bath water for the divers. So the divers had the preference, the priority on the bath. So any bathing was really done by the guys who went diving after they'd done their immersion.
To warm them up again.
To warm them up, yes, yes. So I remember those early days of the shower, and then later on, of course, modern development, decent showers came in, and you know, luxury improved.
As somebody who's concerned about the environment as a biologist, when you were emptying the toilet into the water, did you, in the 1970s, did you think twice about whether this was a good idea or not, environmentally?
Difficult to say. I probably didn't, actually. It was a question of a logistic operation, because you were producing the waste, you had to get rid of it. And it was the same with the cans and the glass bottles and all the other material that we couldn't burn. We were allowed to burn in those days, but not now, of course. And we put those into Gash Cove. Now, that meant that was a precarious job, too, for the Gash man, because you had a big dustbin on a rucksack frame, which you put on your back, and the dustbin was filled with all the hard waste. And you then walked up the hill behind, over into Gash Cove and down to a rocky point where you tipped this lot into the sea. And a lot of it, of course, is there today and can be seen on the bottom. And that was the way we got rid of hard metal and glass gash. So, yes, I probably didn't think of it at the time. OK, it looked bad, but on the other hand, we had no alternative.
What'd you do?
You know. But it was very interesting. A marine colleague of mine later on was doing some experiments and analysing the chemical composition of the bodies of some of the marine invertebrates in Factory Cove, close by the station. And it was quite amazing. He came up with this very strange peak on his gas chromatogram, which was later identified as being derived from L-SAM. So the animal had incorporated this compound into its shell or its skeletal structure, and there it remained.
Because you've been with Bass quite some time, you have lived through a period when all that was tightened up on. Was there any sense of resentment or resistance from the basis when it was suggested that perhaps more careful thought be put into the waste products or into health and safety issues? Mm. Was it embraced all this straight away, or were people resistant to interference?
Yes, I think on base there was considerable resistance to, here's another edict from the environmental managers in Cambridge telling us to do this and so on. And I would guess, yes, and I experienced a bit of this, that, we've now got to do this and it's extra work and so on. And we would try and point out, well, you know, the extra work is worth it in terms of, you know, damage that we're doing down here to reduce it and so on. So I think eventually the message got through, but perhaps something like a year or so it takes, you know, to implement a new thing properly. I remember vividly the bonfires we had, usually on Saturday afternoon, because we'd have scrubber on Saturday morning, and this was where all the base was expected to partake. The base leader would organise the various duties like cleaning up the library or scrubbing out the lounge or painting or whatever. And this would all be done over about 2 to 3 hours in the Saturday morning. Then in the afternoon, all the burnable rubbish was accumulated in the burny heap, as we called it, and we would then burn it on the Saturday afternoon. And then, of course, that was followed with the Saturday evening dinner, which was a special occasion.
Would you stand around the bonfire and warm your hands?
Of course we did. Yes, indeed.
And Saturday night was the highlight of the week, was it?
Well, it was, yes. Signy had a very nice social calendar or social programme throughout the week, and when I was there it was quite well done, because throughout the week you tended, well, alcohol was generally not available, perhaps occasionally on Wednesday evenings, but otherwise it was reserved for Saturday. So Saturday was a very special occasion. You washed and cleaned up, you put on different clothes, you tried to get out of your fid gear, your hairy shirts and stuff like that, and you know, it was very, very nice and comfortable to have a relaxing evening with some drinks, and of course smoking was allowed on base then, and to sit round the table and chat or listen to music or play games and so on after dinner. So yes, Saturday evenings were the highlight. But then Sundays we would have a film, and then either Wednesday would be another film or a slideshow. And these slideshows were very interesting because they would be individuals' efforts, you know, perhaps, you know, more boring pictures of penguins or seals, but you know, but it was the commentary that used to come. You can imagine it. You put a slide up and somebody would make a comment, usually derogatory, you see, and that was the kind of way in which, you know, Signy worked. If you could endure giving a slideshow at Signy, you were a pretty hard person, because they could destroy you.
Were you destroyed in that way?
Partially, yes. I gave a talk in my first summer, I think, on it was kind of some holiday photographs, because I thought the lads been down here for nearly 2 years. Some of them they haven't seen a tree, and so I put in lots of vegetation and so on. And I remember the comments about, you know, the palm trees and the bananas and stuff like that. And I think I showed a picture of my wife and one of the children, and they weren't harmful comments, but they were sort of quite near the grain.
Sense of humour seems to be important in an enclosed environment like that.
Very, very much so, yes. And it was particularly evident when, as newcomers, the summer people came on to station, because they had all, the winterers all had their jokes, and they would know almost by innuendo what they were talking about, whereas as a new boy you'd sit there and wonder what on earth they're talking about, you know.
And this was private language.
That's right, and it was almost in its extreme case there, because they had lots and lots of records on base in those days, you know, vinyls, and they'd play these over the winter and so on, and there was one, I can't remember, it had a series of numbers on it, and the they would merely sit in the lounge and say, oh, let's think about number three, or what about number four, and they'd all laugh, and you had no idea, but they knew this record completely off by heart, so they would enjoy the joke, but we of course couldn't.
You mentioned smoking. That's something I hadn't thought of, and perhaps you know the answer to this. Is smoking now banned in Antarctic buildings since July 1st, 2007?
Oh yes.
So you have to go outside to have a cigarette?
Yes.
How are you going to cope with that in the middle of winter?
Well, I think you're just going to see a decline in people who smoke on base. I think there are rather few people on the Bass stations now that smoke. They've just declined away, I think, really. But there are some, I know.
Because the date was chosen in this country to coincide with the summer, so going outside for a cigarette wasn't that serious.
Mm.
In Antarctic, it's mid-winter.
Yes, we've always had some rules, I think, probably since the early 80s, that smoking was allowed in the lounge or the bar, but not in the labs, not in the bunk rooms or anywhere like that. So it you know, the restrictions have been coming. So yes, it is a problem, but I think it's just going to lead to a decline in smoking generally.
Okay, that was an aside. Right. We've had a fantastic weekend at Cambridge, and I've been impressed through the interviews and through conversation with people, how proud people are of Signy. Being realistic, was Signy, how vital, how important a base was Signy in the greater scope of things?
Well, Signy was the British Antarctic Survey biological station. We did do some biology at South Georgia, and there were the bird programs and the seal programs at Bird Island off South Georgia. But for the basic marine and terrestrial and freshwater work, for probably 40 years of Signy's existence, maybe longer, maybe nearly 50 years, Signy was the prime biological station. And as Martin Holgate said last night in his after-dinner speech, the station people working there have been very, very productive scientifically and have contributed an awful lot to international Antarctic biology. So we were the lead station, and I think it came as not only as a shock, but also as a degree of sadness that we moved from a year-round operation at Cygni to a summer-only, because I think we lost a lot of our good status at that point, in the sense that we're no longer looking at what happens over winter. And of course, biologically, it's not necessarily deep winter or deep summer, it's the changeover of the seasons between summer and winter and winter and summer. This is when the biological activity really gets racked up, both in the marine environment and also on the land. And I think, you know, without your wintering base, you can't study that. And the other thing was the move of a large amount of the programme, particularly the marine and so on, down to Rothera, to an area that largely we didn't know anything about. But that's probably a good reason for going there. But on the other hand, we had this solid base of data and work at Cygni that was not quite cut off, but was certainly terminated and then only carried on later.
Did you spot some disillusionment then in your colleagues when they came back? This is the first reunion since the switch.
Yes, I think there's quite a feeling amongst the attendees at this reunion that of moving the big biological programmes from Cygni. And I think it's reflected actually in what we might call the Cygni community. Probably at this reunion you get the sense that, you know, we've all shared similar experiences and lived on base winter and summer, and we've contributed to a fairly focused programme. But there are very few people who go to Cygni now are present at this reunion. That may be that they don't like reunions, but I think it's also a symptom of the fact that there isn't this Cygni community effort anymore. They go, it's like going quite to the office, but it's a long way away, and unlike the UK, but it's like that sort of feeling, I think. And I think these kind of reunions may well begin to die out as we move on and our members die as well, that the actual spirit of Cygni will probably not be quite what it was.
Okay. Did you learn anything about Cygni this weekend, or have something about Cygni reaffirmed?
Yes, difficult to say without... I'm still full of it and still quite close to it. I think some of the stories that go about and about Cygni, what happened and so on, I think were quite new to me.
Was there a good one that you could relate?
No, I can't really. No, not to bring to mind at the moment. But yes, I think, and some of the loss of tradition and so on possibly was evident this weekend. Yes. I think the loss of the hunting lodge. Now, the hunting lodge was the little field hut at Gourlay, which Nev Jones, who was here, was able to revisit as a tourist the other year, which must have been great for him, because it's now been pulled down and replaced by a garden shed or so, or a rather expensive garden shed, from which the people can do their penguin work and so on. Yes, changes are inevitable.
Did you enjoy the weekend?
Fantastic. I enjoyed it because names became people for me, sitting there, booking them in and you know, on the emails and so on that's come in, all the booking. And then, of course, putting faces to them this weekend has been absolutely marvellous, and meeting all their friends and colleagues, people who have come as guests. It's been really lovely to meet all these folk again. You know, some I never thought... Well, some I hadn't met since 1972 in my first visit.
This is a toughie, but it's the last question, so if you can't answer it, don't worry. What do they have in common, these people, apart from the fact they've been to Cygni? What is a common characteristic of a Cygni person?
I think my view of that would be it's a person who is able to get through and solve most problems, solve them in their own sort of way. I mean, at Cygni we were very much back on our own endeavours, and therefore if you had a problem, a broken piece of machinery or something that didn't work, or some scientific problem even, you'd throw it out at dinner time, and most people would have a go at trying to give you an answer. And I think this is inherent in the Cygni individual, that We have this ability to tackle problems, some of them very large, and in some way get through them. The name FIDBODGE is often made towards making things do, you know, mechanically. But I think that the FIDBODGE also applies a bit to the sort of mental processes, the philosophy that we apply to life and to problems in life. That would be my opinion.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.